Just because they're out on the street and homeless and don't have a job doesn't mean they're not human. They should have human rights where they have a place to live and have something to eat every day, you know?
The biggest thing is when you start losing yourself, you feel like you have no worth. You have nothing to give back. You get deeper into your addictions, and the more guilt you got because you're not around your family, or, and it's getting worse.
Affordable housing is so important. It's the basis to everything. Having stability. And if you have stability, you're able to cope a lot better with, you know, COVID, mental health, addiction. Without affordable housing, without that stability, the rest of that's going to affect your life so much more.
I've never been this well. I swear to goodness, in my entire life.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Winter is Coming. This is a podcast where we are asking how we go from housing crisis to housing justice. And what you just heard at the start of today's episode was the audio from Safe, which is a documentary film from John Butler, a documentary that features tenants of the Indwell affordable housing communities and their stories of being targeted by housing injustice, of living close to the streets, and the hope that comes with supportive, permanent, affordable housing. And if you want to learn more about how you can support the documentary, how you can view that documentary, check out the details in the captions to this podcast, or Google Safe Documentary or search YouTube for Safe Documentary. This is a show where we feature a series of conversations on the housing crisis, and specifically looking at the housing crisis in the north of Turtle Island, in what we now call Canada. And if we zoom into that, our context here, where we're recording from, is the traditional territories for me of the Haudenosaunee, the Anishinaabe, and Neutral peoples, just outside of what we now call Kitchener-Waterloo in the province of Southern Ontario. And we are in our second season here, and we are talking all about how we go from housing crisis to housing justice. And on this show, when we say housing justice, we're talking about the comprehensive approach that really, truly helps us to figure out how do we enshrine housing as a human right, something that we say, we talk a big game about, but we know when we go down our streets in many cities and rural areas that we know we're not living out. So housing justice is not just about one thing. It's about the comprehensive approach that, yes, puts roofs over people's heads, yes, makes things more affordable so people can not have to choose between rent and groceries. Yes, it involves emergency shelters. It also involves supportive housing, affordable housing. So it's looking at this comprehensive approach about how we get from housing crisis to housing justice. And the housing crisis is not a one-size-fits-all approach. And so we need to have lots of voices, lots of perspectives. And that's what the show does. We wanted to take a second this week to let you know who's behind this podcast. Two groups that have come together for the Winter is Coming podcast are Trinity United Church, which is a church in what we now call Kitchener-Waterloo in the province of Ontario, Canada. And they are a church dedicated to advancing housing justice, advancing the resources and infrastructure of supportive housing and affordable housing in their community, but really all over the north of Turtle Island in what we now call Canada. And as well, the Hub Community Network, which is a network of youth and young adults seeded from the United Church of Canada that lives to empower young people to connect with the liberating love of Christ and build a more justice-rooted and inclusive world. So that's who's behind this podcast. Outside of this project, we also run a companion project called the Supportive Housing Advocacy Group. And that group meets two Wednesdays a month online to talk about how we can support each other in advancing affordable housing in our various projects and our activism work in our community, as well as putting out housing advocacy calls to action. So if you want more information on that, you can check the caption below. This week, though, we are returning to part two of the conversation with Kirsten Wright, who is a systems engineer formerly with Leadership Waterloo Region, who is looking at the system of housing. So we're going to continue to look at big picture this week as Kirsten takes us into the need for us to experiment in order to get anywhere with housing and this question of how do we create permanently affordable public housing again in order for us to advance housing justice. So let's dive back in.
So if we want, what do we want from housing? We want that like really great conditions for life for everyone. Right? Like what is in a way the soap level minimum cost for conditions life? We also want the conditions for people to be productive and contribute to society, right? We want to support people in creating value together, whether that's in the artistic space, in their families, in their communities and workplaces. Mm-hmm. And if we recognize the value created in cities is created through that interaction, right? Which is really clear in data about urban spaces and value. We have to treat people's attention as valuable. We have to treat their like self-control, their ability to make promises to themselves, whatever they are, and follow through on as of value, because it is the absolute heart of the value, right? And so if there are people who don't have the basic conditions, like we're evolving in a way our relation to technology is different, right? And so making it structurally so those who face barriers to housing or to having their own room don't have a place where they can sit with a device and a big screen, right? If they're trying to do work that needs you to have multiple windows out, that those are the basic conditions to be productive and to contribute, right? And so blocking that path for big swaths of the community is, I think, a lost opportunity, right? And that's similar with mobility. Like what is the cost of moving? Like what you do to support a kid's doing a startup is very similar to what you do to support an artist who just needs to like really dive into doing this kind of work. And by making the centers of cities really expensive, we're forcing kids into debt in order to self-finance being productive in a world where we can't even promise that they're going to get any of the returns on that investment.
I wanted to catch that because I think it is something that is, as somebody who, for me, who lived in Toronto for a time, and I know this has happened really for like even years ago in places like New York, where people are priced out of urban centers. Tell us a little bit about how you see us changing that. Because it feels like for that, you know, it seems that it's just this runaway train now where it, not everywhere necessarily is Toronto, but as we get closer into urban centers, things are just, people are pushed further and further out from those centers, and therefore they can't get closer to those places of density. They can't get closer to places where then the sharing economy could take place. Like a city center could have a great list of cafes and co-working spaces and parks. But if I have been pushed out because I can't afford to live anywhere near there, and if maybe there's not transit to support me getting there, it feels like it's this runaway train. How can we change that? How can we make sure that the densest areas, which right now tend to be the highest priced in the centers of cities, how can we make those affordable so that we can contribute and participate in a sharing economy?
Yeah, it's not really that hard a problem. The driver of it is that there is value in being close to each other. The most marketable part of that is that we create value, right? In order, you get a wage premium by being close to each other, but there's a whole bunch of social values as well. And if there are limited areas that are dense, but land is almost infinitely divisible. So it is possible to add density where there isn't density, right? And once there's enough density, the center can move there. So you have these linear cities. But fundamentally, if you have only market ownership of it, then you actually undermine the larger economy because that public space, it's creating the value of the interconnection. A disproportionate share can be claimed by those who own the underpinnings of it, right? You have a monopoly ownership over a place when the value is being created by everyone who lives there, right? And disproportionately, you don't know who or when, right? Sometimes people are spending 10 years gaining a skill before they're able to get any of the returns, or it might be even after they die.
Yeah.
So you don't know who, but you know, in aggregate, the value is created by the people in that space, right? With places to walk and good quality air and good food. So you, if you only have private markets that own it, they can claim all of that surplus value, right? Whatever more it is, it's sensible, it's rational to take that out of, and so that's why you see the prices go up, right? But that's not a cost, that's not a production cost, you're just claiming value created by others. So that's why the densest, most productive places need to get to that threshold where you have maybe 20% that's off market, that lets those who need to be in that space, you know, like kids who are building a skill, who are launching a startup or developing an artistic practice, or people who are vulnerable and need access to the social support, can, and so that everyone has the choice, right? Because otherwise you have a monopoly of an extractive system. If you don't have a monopoly of the extractive system, those who are providing housing privately and those who are providing it through a whole range of other mechanisms in various off-market ways are actually competing with each other. So ironically, you actually make a market that's able to go, what do people want, right? And when you do that, you see something much more like, well, this one's 30% higher because the private market can offer that 30% higher value to those who want this extra amenity, right? Maybe like granite countertops or whatever, like pool system or whatever, but you better try as hard as you can. Like the thing about markets is you want to make a strong system that keeps it on its toes, right? It's the same as with people. Like you don't want people that just sit on their couch all the time, and you don't want to be that person. It feels really bad, right? But once you get to the gym, you get stronger and you can do more things. It's exactly the same with markets. We need to find ways to make markets exercise so they get stronger too. Mm-hmm. And having a strong market housing sector is, as far as I can tell, it's the only way to quickly do it at scale. And the problem is we haven't leaned into that, right? We've made a big enough investment, but we haven't made a targeted enough investment. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we are in the strongest position we've ever been in Canada. The non-market housing sector is stronger than it's ever been in terms of capacity and scale and resources.
And why is that?
Because of the National Housing Strategy and the sort of really substantial effort. It's the silver lining of the housing crisis. Because there is such a crisis, we've started to rise together to address it. And so there is enormous and building capacity in the non-market housing sector.
And when we talk about the, when you talk about what it can then look like to, you know, have even 20% be of the property, the buildings, businesses be non-market, is there somewhere you can point to give us, because I think sometimes we often need, you know, if to engender hope, to engender trust, to engender belief and faith in that this is possible, we need vision. Are there places where this is, that are maybe down the road ahead of us, are the places that this is working, whether it's in what we now call Canada or in Europe, or are there places where we see this working that we can point to, and especially for those cynics who go, yeah, that sounds really great, but you know, I guess if it worked that way, it would be so easy. Are there places we can point to where we're seeing this working, or we're seeing the sharing economy and community wealth actually contributing to that soap bubble that you talked about, where it's the optimal place where people are benefiting from clean air and the ability to have space for themselves, the ability to co-work together and to share ideas? Are there places where we're seeing this happening?
Well, we have one of the best experiments I've ever seen emerging locally in Waterloo region with the Build Now project, which is a collaboration that's actually been led by a combination of developers and Habitat for Humanity and Union Cooperative and others in the community. It has involvement across Waterloo, Kitchener, townships, Cambridge. And the idea is build 10,000 half-priced, like perpetually affordable homes that's a mix of privately owned and shared ownership models, and really make the kind of housing that can be, you know, make this a great community for nurses and, you know, people who are working in businesses that like that just sort of make good quality housing across the board. And then part of that may actually be an idea that I know Scott Higgins has been spearheading, which is this notion of free streets, which is if you go up a few stories, you're actually increasing, there's apartments above, right, that are paying rent to live there. If you try and maximize how much you take out of the main floor, you get only a few kinds of things that can survive. banks and loan places and whatever else.
Yeah. A subway.
McDonald's.
Right? Yeah.
But the more vibrant and dynamic that Main Street is, and like the more filled with like plants and things for all people and all species and trails, the better a place it is to live, which mm-hmm. means the more value it is for small apartments, for larger apartments, all the way up the building. So if you actually did something like Free Streets and took that to its logical conclusion, said like, what is the best use of this space for the community to maximize value and productivity and quality of life? You would more than pay for that in increased quality of life, increased health, increased output, and increased willingness of those who are able to pay to be in that community. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you imagine, well, what could we do as a community with enough buildings to house 10,000 people in little centers across? So there's concrete experiments emerging here.
I think that's super helpful to have a sense of even locally where we're seeing this happen. And you talked about Free Streets a little bit. You talked about Build Now, and you talked again about the ability to produce what we talked about last time. And what I was so taken by was this idea of perpetual affordability. Yeah. And so one of the models behind that you talked about is having, there's a mix of private and shared ownership. Again, we're on this theme of the sharing economy. When you say shared ownership, give a sense of what does that look like? Is that a small group of individuals? Is that organizations? Is that a mix of working with municipalities and legislators? What does it look like to have healthy shared ownership of properties like what with Build Now is doing?
So for Build Now, there, I think the breakdown they're talking about is 30% rental, 70% ownership. That basically comes from, that's an average breakdown in the community, but all of those have some mechanism for perpetual affordability. So they never go back up to market, and that additional value by the vibrance of the community, it's not claimed only by those people who live there. It's actually passed forward in the form of affordable housing that can sustain that vibrancy in perpetuity. And it's a model that grows because you take some of the speculation out of the model, then it becomes easier to execute that model in other places, right? And grow those centers. In terms of what it can look like for ownership, I would say look at Vienna and Singapore.
I thought you mentioned Vienna. Yeah.
They have a fairly strong cooperative and public housing sector, especially public housing. So for there in Vienna, there's good quality publicly owned housing that's not just, it's not means tested. So anyone could have the choice of living there and just save more of their income, right? So it's a more of a viable choice. And importantly, you can't typically tell if someone's rich or not by seeing them go into their front door. So the sort of stigma around
what a refreshing
it,
idea.
More amenity inside, but you know, kids don't have that experience being like, oh, I'm going to a big house and you're going to a small house. It doesn't, the status doesn't sort of infuse people's sense of possibility in the same way.
And so again, knowing that approaches are always contextual and the context of a place like Vienna is obviously very different than here in Canada, but how to start to give us a sense of how we get there. Public housing in Canada was really, especially in the last 30 years, has been really, especially by legislators, abandoned or really at least kind of pushed to the side, where we've stopped investing in public housing. And what does it take for us where we are now, especially if we look at, you know, when you talk about that, about the idea of people being able to have the agency to save more of their income by not paying through the nose, which we know, especially so many people have to spend right now in the rental market alone, like 60-70% of income on living alone. And we know that when you go and apply for a mortgage, they don't really want you to be paying more than 40%. And yet they're part of a system that is pushing it far beyond that, which is why we need things like the stress test now. How do we get now to a place where we can, where we really reinvest in public housing? That sounds like it really requires legislators at municipal, provincial, and federal levels, which can feel like, for a lot of people, with a especially with the current state of politics and this perpetual campaign and the way that we spend so much time on not tackling problems and the cynicism that understandably comes with saying, oh, well, we need the help of politicians and legislators. How do we get there? How do we get to more public housing as one of the ways, alongside like shared ownership, to tackling this this crisis and getting beyond the surface deep rhetoric of saying, well, we just need more homes. When we're not talking about, are those homes actually going to be $1 million mini mansions? Are those homes actually going to destroy habitats? We're recording right now after the Greenbelt decision has just been reversed a couple weeks ago. So there's some progress, but how do we get to advocate and see more public housing?
And basically it's leadership and sustained investment. And I think the way we get there is through ambitious experiments, things like the build now, like, let's just do it, right? How can we build this? How can we build a system and show it works and get momentum on those first projects and then scale that model out while also advocating for something that's tested, right? And that look, this is a framework that could work. And I think the two advantages that we have right now is the strength of the non-market housing sector, broadly speaking, after sustained higher than was the case before investment through the National Housing Strategy. And then the other thing is if we think this is a bad year with climate change, well, we have El Nino next year, right? So those unprecedented numbers that we're seeing now, it's going to get worse. And there's going to be a massive push for climate-hardened infrastructure and buildings, right? And so having the political, institutional, the engineering readiness to solve that problem. So when we build back from the crises we know are coming, and when we begin to invest in hardening the infrastructure and those larger flows that are like the biodiversity financing, the climate financing, making sure that those go into solutions that actually work for everyone. Right. And then offer some real climate resilience, like the basements are safe for everybody. Yeah. Right. And available for everyone. So if you're upstairs or downstairs, you can actually all be safe in the case that there's a hurricane, if there's a worse storm, that there's some, cycling of water in the community, that that we're planting deep rooted perennials, all of these things that we know will prevent the floods in the years. So we are going to be rebuilding an awful lot of infrastructure. Currently, we're rebuilding basically whatever was there. Right. And so actually doing that work on, well, what is the hard infrastructure? How do we create the built forms that get everyone through through the next 50 years until we can pull back from this cliff?
We could go so many branches here, but I really appreciate highlighting a couple of those things about the need to trust and reinvest in infrastructure. I think that's a topic that is easy to point fingers when you look south of the border and look at the U.S. and their critical problem with crumbling infrastructure, but to recognize that that's a problem for us too that needs to be addressed, and the ability as well to experiment. I think that can be hard for a lot of people to trust on a grassroots level, because an experiment naturally has risk. Experiments will fail, but we can't have this antiseptic approach where we'll just theorize our way to it and we'll simply be able to analyze our way through it. We have to try things, and we have to be practicing and being on the ground. So making space in our communities, and especially because so many of those experiments, I think especially right now, will happen, might have investment at federal and provincial levels, but they will happen locally and need to happen locally, because housing, again, is so contextual to the land that we're on, the communities that have been built, the people who are in those communities. So being able to advocate for us to have progress and experiment is crucial. And I think helping people understand the intersections of that is vital, because we have, if we even look at something that we've talked about on this show before, folks who struggle with addictions, who naturally have huge intersections with inability to have sustainable and safe housing. We know now through experiments and now through time-tested research and practice and at testimonials, safe supply is a really important aspect of how we help people heal from and move beyond addictions. But that still, to many people, seems radical. It seems experimental. And so people don't, especially in places like Cambridge, we have people who do not want to get on board with that. We need to be able to experiment with housing solutions for us to get anywhere. And so I think that's a helpful, I don't know in this conversation if we can help identify exactly how we get individuals there who are naturally going to have a lot of skepticism over something like an experiment, but even just to know as a flag for us, as a roadmap for us, that experimentation on the ground, trying things is vital, I think is really important for us to understand.
And I think it's also important to understand that we have to build a lot of new housing anyways because of population growth. So making sure some of that follows best practices and addresses the areas of greatest need, it's almost a no-brainer, right? It's just filling the gaps. Like, we have a housing market that does a lot of things right under the right circumstances. And there is a particular moment of opportunity right now because the pro forma with the higher interest rates, pro formas for some of the established projects are harder to get built, right? So you're seeing delayed projects, which means there's an opening for models that are in some ways actually better, right? And so as just being supportive of that, having conversations about it, learning a bit so that, because it's going to go or not go on the basis of public support. And that's, what a lot who are most vulnerable depend on.
It's, yeah.
That we talk to each other.
And that's kind of a perfect place for us in this conversation. And I know we'll chat in another episode, Kristen, because again, every time we chat, there's so many places I go, oh, well, now we have to talk about that. And we want to make our episodes be able to be contained and focused enough for a sitting. So as we kind of close this and come back to housing and the sharing economy, what's one thing we need in pursuing a healthy community wealth-based sharing economy in order to help the future of housing? What's one thing we either need to do more of or change in order to help the future of affordable housing?
I mean, just to keep on the same track, we need more housing of that kind that we have. We have too little perpetually affordable housing. It's hard to finance. It's hard to build. And there's not sort of one silver bullet for it. It's a scattershot, right? There are a whole bunch of really promising pieces that as a community, we need to do in parallel, right? We need to get, the 150 to 400 people out of the cold this winter.
Yes.
And we need to build housing because we don't have enough. We also need to protect existing affordable housing and make sure that there's really good market and not market housing right across the spectrum, right? So it takes leadership, it takes sustained investment, and sort of each project that gets green belt, if union cooperative, if we invest in union cooperative and we buy one building and take it off the market, that's amazing, right? I don't think there is a silver bullet, but I think there are some of the most inspiring emerging projects in this region that I've seen anywhere. So that's what I'm excited about.
And I think that's just to highlight again, some that we've chatted through this whole conversation, places for people to learn more would be learn more about Union Cooperative. They're working really hard to get permanent affordability, to get community ownership. And so if you're somebody who's been frustrated, hurt, targeted by the speculative real estate market, or by maybe you live, and I can identify this firsthand, maybe you've lived in an apartment building where it's owned by a corporation who doesn't give any care to leaks or maintaining safety inside. Maybe all they're doing is landscaping the front so they can get more rentals. Community ownership, the ability to move beyond these investment firms owning our high density buildings. Union Cooperative is working really hard, in particularly in what we now call Waterloo Region, to move that forward. And then Build Now was another one that came up in this conversation, just to highlight again, learn more about what Build Now Waterloo Region is doing. You can visit them at buildnowwr.ca. Union Cooperative is unionsd.coop. So go learn more about what they're doing. Find out how you can get involved and how you can advocate at local levels to your provincial MP, to your federal MP, to your local city councillors as those. Are there any other organizations or experiments, particularly in Waterloo or in Southern Ontario, that you want to highlight for us as places people can go to learn more and to get vision of how we don't have to be trapped in this existing predatory market of ownership and rentals?
Well, I think that the thing that comes into my mind is not just the housing, but people's patterns of volunteering have shifted so much over the course of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I think the housing, there's a risk that the housing advocacy people become separate from, you know, people working on food systems or ecological systems, or
become siloed off from intersections. Yeah.
So I would suggest, you know, signing up for the newsletter for Volunteer Waterloo Region, because you've seen a lot of people who had a habit of volunteering before the pandemic, and then it was closed and habits changed, haven't necessarily picked that up again, right? And I think we need a sustained process of rebuilding those sort of connections and that sort of pattern of like service and relationship in our communities.
That's a great thing.
And we can always learn more in housing for ourselves, but how do we also connect and work together with people in all these other systems? Because that's what will build the shared motivation to actually get the leadership we need in this area and volunteer in all these different areas. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's great. Yeah, so that's volunteerwr.ca. Yeah, and that's whether you're in Kitchener, in Cambridge, in Waterloo, they can connect you with, as we've said, housing intersects with pretty much everything. And so, yeah, we need folks at the KW Community Fridge. We need folks investing in youth programs. I'm obviously biased as someone who leads a youth program in the hub. We need folks who are working with our seniors, some of the people that are being quietly targeted so much by housing injustice. So that's great. We'll post the links to these as well. Kirsten, I'm so, even though every time we talk, I go, oh my gosh, I have 90 more questions and there's 80 more topics we have to talk about. That is a real blessing. One of those good discomforts that we talked about earlier, where we go, oh, that leads us to another question. So we will absolutely have you back on, because you just bring not only such an expertise and such good insight and such great experience, but Kirsten, you bring such a great passion and energy and everything, even as we're talking about something that can look so grim as the housing crisis, you bring such a hopeful energy to this. And I think it's so needed for us when we talk about sustainability, the sustainability to stay in the fight as everyday people and to say this is going to be a long process, but we have really immediate opportunities to make change. You really engender that in me. And I think I can say that for a lot of our listeners too. So thank you for the energy and the hope that you bring into this, because it is so critical for us to move forward to have that hope. So thanks for being here and bringing that again into the conversation.
Thank you so much for everything you're doing and in bringing this and sort of centering the whole richness of the crisis and the potential.
That is all for this week. We will talk with Kirsten again soon, and you'll hear another episode from us every Tuesday for the next few weeks, and we will see you next time. So for Winter is Coming, I am Adam Cresswell. Thanks again, Kirsten Wright, Systems Design Engineer, for joining us. We will talk to you next time.